This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 17th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Today I'm joined by theatre critic Matt Wolfe. Up for discussion we have Bradley Cooper as John Merrick in a new production of Elephant Man, a reboot of Noel Coward's outrageous family drama Hay Fever at the Duke of York's Theatre, and a new play based in the world of semi-professional football, soccer, to those of you listening on the other side of the pond, called The Red Lion. That's all to come here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Matt. Great to
Thank
have you with
it's
us.
It's a pleasure, as always.
Let's begin with a new production of Bernard Pomerantz's 1977 play, The Elephant Man, starring Bradley Cooper as John Merrick, the classic tale of Don't Judge a Book by Its Cover. We follow Merrick, whose face is deformed by tumours that have landed him in a travelling freak show, as his intelligence and resounding desire for love are revealed. Now, I guess the starting point for this is Bradley Cooper perhaps wouldn't seem to be the most obvious pick straight away for a variety of reasons to depict John Merrick, but he does. What was the thinking in that casting, and how does he get on?
Well, Tom, the fact is this has sort of been an obsession of his. He's been wanting to do this play this part for a very, very long time. He, you know, actors look for roles. They often scope out work. When you get to be an actor at the level that he is, you can make things happen, which is one of the advantages of being a star. And so he was aware of this story. It's a story that's been out there. The play has been revived several times in America. There was a movie, different script, but same story, obviously, with John Hurt and Anthony Hopkins. So it's not a surprise that he knew it. And he had done it at a small but very good regional theater in Massachusetts a couple of summers ago, then on Broadway, where I saw it this past winter. And now, very interestingly, that production, the Broadway production directed by Scott Ellis, has been picked up lock, stock, and barrel and moved to the Haymarket in London. And that's actually quite unusual. You tend to have more examples of things going the other way. Shows from London that are picked, like Wolf Hall at the moment, the Hilary Mantel, that get, you know, exported in their entirety to New York. It doesn't happen so much from New York to London, particularly when it's an English story. So here, I mean, the strange thing probably for British audiences are here are all these, you know, nice American actors in London playing Brits.
And what about his the journey he goes on? Because this, people would imagine, oh, there's going to be heavy duty prosthetics and all of this kind of disguising. But he goes back to, you know, the classic actor's craft. It's all done, you know, in a very sort of naked and open way. Does that work, do you think?
It works very well. I mean, the style of this play, and I have seen various other iterations of this play before Bradley Cooper. Billy Crudup did a revival of it some years ago, and he was very good, actually. And I remember the original production, which had in it David Bowie at one point. But the whole thing is, you're not going to have in the play what obviously John Hurt does on screen, where he transmogrifies into this guy, like when Charlize Theron became, you know, Eileen Wuornos in Monster and won an Oscar for that. This is different. Bradley Cooper looks like Bradley Cooper, and you're looking at him wearing not very much. And then as the character's disfigurement and debilities are described, he adopts them physically. But it's all about the power of the imagination, so that you are crossing the footlights, investing in his distress, his deformities, his various malignancies, and that's the empathy. And actually, I quite like that, because it works on the imagination, which is what theater is about.
Now, a number of sort of pieces of criticism that I've read about this production suggest that whilst Cooper is a compelling stage presence, the production, despite some, you know, very able kind of supporting terms as well, is a little on the heavy side. It can be a bit lacking in pace. It's maybe a little sluggish. Would you sort of go along with that?
Yeah, I did see sluggish used. I don't know. I mean, I've seen the play before, so I sort of know what the play is. I don't think the play is profound. It's not going to win the Nobel Prize. It's really... it's kind of an old style play, Tom, in that it's the kind of thing there used to be a lot of. It's a vehicle. It's a vehicle for an actor who wants to sort of strut his stuff. Although I suppose the paradox of it, or the contradiction, is that Bradley Cooper, although self-evidently the star, doesn't treat it as the star vehicle. For instance, at the curtain call, it's a company bow. He never steps forward by himself. He is sharing a dressing room, I'm told, with his very good co-star, Alessandro Nivola. And in fact, the role of John Merrick isn't actually the biggest role in the play. The biggest role in the play is the doctor, Frederick Treves, played by Nivola. And it's one of those classical cases of, you know, physician, heal thyself, i.e. intending to the distress of this deformed creature, the doctor has to deal with his own deformities, which are emotional, not physical. The play's a bit glib, and actually the movie digs more deeply. But Bradley Cooper can act on stage. He did actually begin in the theater. He's not one of these people like when Julia Roberts did a play some years ago in New York with Bradley Cooper, and she was airlifted into Broadway from, you know, the world of celluloid. It's like, now I stand on the stage and I speak? Bradley knows what he's doing. And I think that's very nice probably for English audiences to see that.
And just, I guess, a final sort of thought on that then. This idea of a star vehicle in that way, does it worry you as a critic? I'm sure you, and the thing is, you've seen a lot of very, you know, of great performances. Is there a part of you that thinks, you know, not to be a purist about, you know, stagecraft or whatever, but that thinks, you know, you'd want to see a stage actor strutting their staff as opposed to a, you know, a buff Hollywood star who's kind of rolls into
town? Yeah, I mean, I absolutely take your point. And it's interesting, the very first production of this play at the Hampstead Theatre in North London, I think 1977 or 1978, had a British actor, David Schofield, who I don't know whatever happened to him. But since then, it's really gone to, you know, well-known film names and good-looking well-known film names, so that there is that direct contrast between, as you say, their buffdom and what they're asked to become. It's never been played by, you know, the likes of a Toby Jones or Simon Russell Beale. That would be very interesting. It's also played by actors who, whether American or English, sound in their English accent very proper, very clipped. You might wonder, is that how the real Joseph Merrick, who really was more or less rescued from the streets, is that how he would have sounded? I mean, I have no idea, but it sounds a bit fanciful to me. I have nothing against a star vehicle if the star can deliver, and in this case, he can deliver. If that were the only thing London had, I would think that was a shame, but since it isn't, it's fine with me.
And it's welcome to add to the sort of the general menu on offer in the West End. That's The Elephant Man, which is on at the Theatre Royal Haymarket until the 8th of August. Let's head to the Duke of York's Theatre, Matt, next for the latest production of Noel Coward's play Hay Fever. Felicity Kendall takes up the main role of Judith, a once glittering star of London stage, who has to fight her husband and two children for the spotlight. Hay Fever follows the unconventional, risque and often downright rude family as they each invite a guest to their rural retreat and an outrageous weekend in Berkshire ensues. This is a production, I guess, that sticks quite closely to the original in a number of respects. Is that almost necessarily a problem? Is it inviting criticism by comparison almost?
Well, the funny thing about this production is there are so many productions nowadays of the classics that seem to tilt whatever the play is on its ear, usually at places like the Young Vic, sometimes the Old Vic, that it's actually rather rare to see a classic play just done straight up. I mean, this is the straightforward Noel Coward cocktail from 1925, shaken and stirred, but, you know, what you see on the tin, or in this case on the poster, a, you know, ringleted Felicity Kendall at her most blonde, is exactly what you get. And this is a star vehicle as well. I mean, the fact is, Felicity Kendall's not as big a star as Bradley Cooper, but, you know, there's a certain generation, I would venture to bet, particularly of English men, for whom Felicity Kendall has a certain appeal and a certain provenance. And this is a good role for her. I really like Hay Fever. It's a play I've seen a lot, and I love its sort of comedy of bad manners. And one of the things I really like about it is the fact that apparently, historically, Sir Noel based the vainglorious thespian family at the heart of the play on a group of Americans. Now, who'd have thought that?
I just can't believe that.
I mean, heaven forbid. So, except here we are in suburban England, and it's the blissfully named Judith Bliss, who is the actress played by Felicity Kendall, and she's everything you would expect a capital A actress to be, married to a writer played very well in this production by Simon Shepherd, and they have two kind of deliciously obnoxious children called Simon and Sorrel. And what happens is that each of these four members of the family invites a guest down for the weekend, not knowing that the other members of the family have done the same, and chaos ensues. But the trick, and this isn't giving anything away, I'm sure most people know what happens basically, is that the Blisses realize that they are more interesting to one another than any of their guests. So the guests arrive, and after too much time realize this is not for us, and they make their escape. Because the Blisses, being theater folk, are just bigger, grander, greater, funnier, and more entertaining than the rest of us mere mortals. So it's delightful. It's very sort of, it's a true situation comedy. I know that phrase is often used pejoratively now, but in this play, the comedy derives from the situation, which is what I just described. So there isn't necessarily a lot of that dreaded word subtext. There's not necessarily a lot to discover. You have to play it lightly. You have to play it glancingly. You have to play it without a care in the world. And that's what the cast does very well.
And I guess credit to that also goes to the director, Lindsay Posnan, because you need to handle this with, as you say, a certain lightness of touch and allow the nuance and the humor and the wit of the great writing to do its own thing.
Almost. That's right. I mean, there was a production, this play comes around a lot, rather like the number 43 bus. And there was a production a couple years ago on the West End with Lindsay Duncan and Jeremy Northam. And that was an interesting production. But in that one, they try to sort of deconstruct it and mine it for all of, you know, whatever its other qualities are. And I admire that. But at the end of the day, Coward was such a master of a really vanished comic art that just having it, you know, presented in a gin glass, or probably more accurately, a champagne cocktail, is what you want and is what you get. And the funny thing about Felicity Kendall is there isn't another actress I've ever come across who has quite her vocal quality. She has this rather extraordinary gurgle in her voice, which she's always had, which makes a sound whenever she speaks as if she's gargling. And it's very, very distinctive. It is kind of adorable. And sometimes it can be a bit winsome, which actually is a word that gets used in the play, but it works very well for this part.
It sounds lovely, doesn't it? Served up in a champagne glass, as it is. Hay Fever is on until the beginning of August at Duke of York's Theatre. Let's end, shall we, Matt, by talking about what's on at the National Theatre, a new play, after quite some hiatus from Patrick Marber. This is The Red Lion, dwelling in the world of semi-pro football, telling the story of a brilliant young player who arrives from nowhere, an ambitious manager determined to make him his own. What about, before we talk about Marber and this play, football on the stage, is that something that we've seen it before here and there? Does it generally work? Do you sort of approach it with a degree of trepidation, perhaps?
Well, believe it or not, I actually like football, and I've strangely been to a couple of football matches in my life. But even if I hadn't, the thing about football and the reason it works theatrically is because it constructs its own world. It's as much its own onstage world as the world of the Bliss theatricals in Hay Fever. And what you want, I would imagine, as a playwright is a situation that gives you a kind of community. And football, needless to say, is its own community. And it's interesting that later this week we have the press performances, although it doesn't actually open till next week, of the musical Bend It Like Beckham, of course adapted from a movie in which football is at the center. And one of the most famous plays in English literary history is a play called The Changing Room by David Storey, which is about the world of sport, not necessarily football. So sport can lend itself very well to this. I can absolutely see why Patrick Marber was drawn to this because, well, his sort of career-making play was a play about guys playing poker called Dealer's Choice. So he's interested in the bonds between men, very much between men. There are no women in this play. He's interested in notions of loyalty, the older and the younger. What happens when you have a new recruit? Who does that new recruit report to and respond to? It's tribal. And this is a tribal world, just like the world of poker is a tribal world. And the backstory to this play, I think, is really quite affecting, in that Patrick hadn't written a play for about a decade. And, you know, the thing about any writer is, why should they necessarily write another play or novel or screenplay? I mean, they write when they're ready to. Nobody, you know, nobody forces them to write. And actually, when you've had great success early on, as he had with Dealer's Choice and then, in my view, his masterpiece Closer, that is thrilling, but it's probably also to some degree inhibiting because it's a lot of success very early. And how do you top that? Some writers never top their early successes. I don't think, to be honest, this play is the equal of Dealer's Choice and Closer, but I'm also not sure that really matters. I think what it represents is a return to use the sports imagery, it's a return to the pitch. He's out there, he's playing, and it's certainly a good play, and it gets him back in the world. And the interesting thing is he has another play, which is opening in July, also at the National, adapted from Turgenev's Month in the Country. So two plays returning. What's interesting here is that it's a new play, but it feels like other plays I've seen. And again, I don't mean that pejoratively. There's a David Mamet play now in the West End called American Buffalo about tribal loyalties amongst three guys, a younger, older, and one in the middle. And that's exactly what this is. And I wouldn't be surprised, because I know Patrick Marber knows his theater, whether the kind of specter of David Mamet and that play was hanging over this. And even the language of codes and bonds, and as I say, loyalty, is very, very applicable both to American Buffalo and to this, even though the milieus are very different. What's lovely about this, two things. One is Ian Rickson, the director, who used to run the Royal Court. He's so meticulous. I mean, when he gives you a world, as anyone will know who saw his magnificent production of Jerusalem, he really gives you a world. So you feel instantly as if you're in the changing room of this semi-professional club somewhere in southern England. And the other is it's a great opportunity for actors. And you've got three really good actors, Denny Mays, Peter White, and Calvin Demba, playing kind of guys with everything to lose, everything to win, and kind of somewhere in the middle. And Marber is good at the male psyche, kind of at moments of extremes. Where is it going to go? Are they going to make it? Are they going to lose it? What next if they lose it? So it's definitely worth seeing.
And just about that, you mentioned the sort of slight hiatus that Marber had in terms of his writing for the stage. As a critic, do you look at, you know, writers, especially ones who've produced something like you mentioned closer, you know, a seminal work, a really brilliant piece.
Yeah.
And you wait, and a bit of time passes and some more time passes. What are you thinking? Are you thinking, wow, I'm really interested to see what the kind of comeback's going to be like? I'm sure you feel a degree of sort of empathy. As you mentioned, there's a lot of weight on the shoulders. Is it a process that, where there's a bit of a hiatus, that you find quite interesting to observe these talents?
Oh, it's a really good question. I mean, the arc of a playwriting career is by definition mysterious. I mean, there's a remarkable woman named Margaret Edson who wrote one play, as far as I'm aware, that won the Pulitzer Prize in New York some years ago. It was done in London. It's called Wit, about a woman dying of cancer. And she said when she wrote the play, that was the only play she had in her. She was, so everyone said, well, now you've written this great play, you're a playwright. And she said, well, I don't know if I'm a playwright. This is the one play I have to write. The American writer Neil Simon, who's, you know, been around forever, it was once said of him, Neil Simon didn't have an idea for a play this year, but he wrote one anyway. And I think Patrick Marber, to his credit, would never do that. I think if he didn't have an idea for a play, he wouldn't write one anyway. I think he had to wait until it was actually there. And maybe being aware of other plays, which is why The Mamet, not a bad thing. There's a little bit of Arthur Miller in this. There's a kind of attention must be paid style speech late on in the play that feels like Death of a Salesman filtered through Patrick Marber. So he's a real theater creature, and he's bringing his knowledge and love of the theater to bear as much as his knowledge and love of football. But what's great about the world of football is it makes it seem absolutely singular. It doesn't look like, oh, it's just this other play rewritten. It looks like something entirely fresh. And if this then spurs him to write the next one, great. If, on the other hand, he doesn't write another one for 20 years, well, who are we to judge?
That's a pretty good point on which to leave it. Matt Wolfe, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
As ever. Red Lion is on at the National Theatre until the end of September. This has been the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks to our producer, Holly Fisher, and researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again tomorrow, The Week in Books, up for discussion with Claire Conville. Until then, goodbye from me and the team. Thanks very much for listening.